Logical, the UAE's first regular legal podcast. My name's Tim Elliott, and I'm here with the managing partner of Yarmolova and Pletka. That is Ludmila Yarmolova. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Tim.
Look, this time we're going to dive into the most common mistakes businesses make when they start up in the UAE. And I'm kind of looking forward to this. What it truly takes to build a successful venture. Let's set the stage, Ludmila. Share some of your own experiences, if you would, starting your practice. And I know it was wonderfully professional from day one. Don't get me wrong. But how it compared to others building their businesses around about the same time?
Yes. Yeah, so today's topic, as you rightfully said, it's about startups. It's less about businesses coming into the UAE, established businesses from outside. Yeah. But it's more just somebody having an idea. A new idea, a novel idea, and trying to launch their own startup. So that's what it's about. And as you rightfully said, this is a topic that is quite close to my heart because I'm not just a lawyer with over, my goodness gracious, more than 25 years, but also someone who has built and run my own law practice for more than 16 years now. So the insights I'll share today come from not only from my experience and challenges, you know, my own experience and challenges or through my clients, but also from my personal journey of running a business in the UAE. So, yeah, it's a quite an interesting topic. And much of what I want to talk about today is, you know, certainly comes from my own experience starting up, but also comparing it to the very various experiences of my many clients that have come to me over the years.
Well, let's walk back to when you first set up then, when you first decided, right, this is what I'm going to do. I like the look of that office, or, you know, even stages before that. Let's go back to then.
Yeah, so it was back in 2009, and I had been in the UAE for about a year then, but I did have a few friends, and that was still a little bit of kind of, I think it started out and during the financial booms, so we had not quite hit the crash at that point. And so there was a lot of excitement, exuberance in the UAE about businesses, ideas. Everybody had a novel idea.
Oh,
and there was, a lot of people who were trying to set up businesses and they were so convinced in the success of their businesses. And fair enough, at the time, it was fairly easy to make money if you were in certain kinds of businesses. And so at the time, you know, a few of my peers, as I was starting out, a few of my peers were also building what seemed to be like successful businesses. But what set them apart is that, you know, most of them had been in the UAE for much longer. I came as a newbie with no connections or contacts. And so they were, some of them were quite connected in one way or another, but it was through these connections that they also were financially supported or funded by some of these contacts. So, in other words, they were building businesses with other people's money. So I guess I didn't really come here planning to set up a business. So it sort of happened more organically. But as I was going through the process, I knew that perhaps some of it because I wasn't really planning on setting up my own business, some of it because of what I do for a living, and that is law. And so some of it is kind of the ethical obligations that are embedded in the legal profession. But I wanted to I wanted to build a business that was within my means. So a business that I myself could fund and not have to rely on other people's money. So it was, you know, interesting to kind of to see my little struggles at the time were obviously compartmentalized because I didn't exceed my limits too much because I couldn't. When you build, when you do anything within your means, you know exactly what your means are, and you are not even able to go beyond that because you have no room. There's no cushion. And so, I could only do what I could do, but I could see some of my peers who were building businesses were somewhat a little bit like, not envious, but you're thinking, my goodness, you know, they're doing such a great job. But, you know, they're growing so fast and had this very flashy facades to their ventures. But, you know, I made a deliberate decision to use only my own funds and scaling only as much as I could afford. So this approach obviously kept me, my business a lot more in the long run, more sustainable and grounded, but at times very challenging because every dirham that I have to spend. I feel it. I feel it in my back. I still feel it today. So I know exactly what it takes because that's the money I earn is what basically I build my business with. And then when you're starting out and you're still kind of a new business, you don't really have much of a cushion. So whatever you want to invest in, be it in the website or your IT infrastructure or your office, all that required an investment, and so that obviously would have had to come from savings, which I didn't have because I was new. So it was purely what I was generating on a monthly basis, what I was investing into the various aspects of my business. But you know, as a result, fast forward 16 years, you know, I've seen a lot of those businesses who were set up with these very flashy facades and big sort of PR campaigns. And, you know, for some time, they might have actually even been financially successful. But many of them have since then kind of closed down, faded out of our sort of memory. And this doesn't just apply to my personal friends and peers, but obviously quite a bit through my clients' experience. And so the experience, the examples I've seen, and the businesses I've had to close or help clients close. So just, I guess, kind of circling back, I'm glad I've done things the way I have. I haven't been able to grow as much as maybe other businesses would have grown in my place, or, you know, if you were to seek advice of investors, you know, as investors would have wanted you to grow. But it's been sustainable and it's been grounded. And as a result, I've been able to weather even storms like COVID. So because we're just, you know, we're not stretched very thin. We don't have any loans, no sort of liabilities. It's always been very grounded. But as a result, sort of what we have and what we do as a team is, you know, is also very measured. And we don't have these, you know, today we're going to quadruple our office and buy expensive art and drive fancy cars and build, you know, buy expensive furniture. It's been very measured.
Yeah, well, you're not that kind of person, are you? I mean, I've known you for what? How long is it? It's probably 12 years?
I think maybe 13. 13, yes. I think shortly after I came here, we met on Dubai Eye.
In the corridors of some radio station somewhere, I suppose. But, you know, you're not that kind of flash character. And I think what your common sense approach, if you listen to this thing, how do I build a business? It strikes me that it's a really sensible way to do it, if it's the way that you are going to do it, because you are living within your means. And it's so difficult to think, oh, I'll go and take a loan and I'll have a little bit more money and I'll spend this on that. But if you can stop yourself from, you know, straying into that territory.
It's not easy. Trust me, I've had my lows and plenty of lows. Because you know, especially when you're seeing other businesses, including your clients, to be able to make the investments. And it's just, we're talking about basic investments, a website, right? It seems simple enough, but remember, this was 16 years ago. So now maybe it'd be easier to just, there's lots of services through which you can build a website. But back then it wasn't, you kind of needed to know what to do. So you're just hiring somebody to help you build your website. Yeah. You know, even just now you've got ChatGPT, you can help us draft profiles, and, you know, about my firm. Back then, everything had to go from me. And I wanted the website to reflect, you know, what I did and who I was. And so that meant drafting or writing about the firm, about myself, about my various team members, about the services we provide, all had to come from me. So that's just the time that it took. But that was kind of part of the journey, and that's how I've done it. You know, while others, I could see, you know, they had budgets to hire copywriters, they had budgets to hire website developers. They had budgets to do marketing and advertising campaigns and brochures and whole branding. So they had budgets for their IT infrastructure and so on and so forth. So, you know, it was harder to do, but it's, you know, whenever you do anything with other people's money, there's always strings attached.
There are. That's absolutely right. When you sat down and decided, right, I'm going to start my own business here, and you got your head around the concept and the idea that you were going to do it, what kind of diligence did you do? What kind of business plan did you put together? I know you weren't looking for funding, but you must have decided, I'm going to do this, 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 this. And if I do this, I will be able to do this and this? What was the path?
It's a great question, and perhaps in the way this maybe sets me apart from other startups, in particular startups that perhaps we want to talk about today, is that I'm not even sure how I found myself in the position of starting my own firm. So I didn't have that. Like I didn't have this aha moment. Okay, I'm going to build this. And this is going to be my budget. Although this is what I want to talk about today, what the startup should do. But at that time, because I was in the services industry, right? So it's just using my own head, using my own knowledge. And so it was more like, okay, I need a license and I need an office.
Yeah.
And a little bit of a budget, but I didn't need many employees because at the time it was basically, it's kind of me that I started with and one or two people here and there. So it was more just that, okay, being able to afford rent, to afford license, first of all, to be properly licensed, to afford rent and afford overheads, whatever they were, and to afford salaries. So that was my footprint. So I started out at a service office, and then a service office, the beauty of service office, obviously it's more expensive as a kind of a per square foot proposition, but it comes with a whole package, right? It already comes, the office already comes set. You don't need to invest in the fit out. You don't need to set up any of the utilities and put deposits as a result. You don't need to have your own IT infrastructure. Sort of, it's all kind of provided. So that's how I started. So that was easier to forecast and budget on that basis because you had a package. You basically look like a plug in. That's why service offices are helpful because it's truly a plug in. So you come in, you plug in, and so at that point you just needed to have been able to pay that monthly invoice. And at the time, a lot of these payments were you had to pay up front. So it's like 6 months or 1 year or 3 months. So you kind of right away by virtue of, before you move into the office, you already paid for a few months ahead. And that included your electricity and all the other utilities. And so then I just needed budget for my employees. So it was kind of very basic budgets, right? It was easier to do by virtue of starting out. In the service office as a more or less like a solo practice. Even to do that, I needed to have done kind of due diligence. I knew that setting up is not so simple, that you have to pay a license and there's different licenses, and it just like wasn't so simple just anywhere. You had to be, you had to kind of choose which zone you had to be and apply for that license. So there's due diligence about how to do it for sure, and just make sure that legally you're standing on the right platform. And then, as much as maybe I wanted to be in the bigger office, nicer location, that was part of my kind of, I guess, indirect due diligence is looking at different offices, realizing, it's too expensive. This is okay. This office looks like nice footprint and such, but it's going to take me X amount of money to make it operational by virtue of having to invest in fit out, and that's money up front. Yeah. So I did that through that sort of due diligence and calculating, okay, well, it's better for me instead of putting so much money up front. As a business, it's hard to put in that initial investment. But I knew I could afford, because that's the beauty of service offices, they're more flexible. You can just kind of roll after the first 3 or 6 months, depending on the package you take. You can just roll from month to month with like 1 or 2 months notice period. So that was kind of my due diligence. I knew about the license. I did do the due diligence on that. I knew about the startup costs, and this is why I chose to go through a service office. And I knew basically what I approximately could make per month. I've looked at the type of work that's coming my way to determine what kind of an employee or help I could afford. Basically that was sort of, that was my own process. It wasn't like I had I sit down and did a PowerPoint presentation and, or did Excel spreadsheet where I kept everything. It wasn't that way. It was all kind of just sort of in the back of my mind. Because it was fairly small operations, so it was easier. Sure. And because I was always living within my means, so I knew like, okay, I couldn't hire that employee because I don't make enough. Okay, I could not buy a new car because I don't have enough money. So it was more or less very sustainable. But because I was living, kind of was paying on an ongoing basis with the money I was making.
That's your experience. But I mean, I think a lot of entrepreneurs, from the people I talk to, overlook due diligence. Just don't do it. And I've often wondered, is that inexperience? Is it, it'll just happen when I want it to happen. I don't need to worry about that. What is it? Why do people not do it?
So I think, one is that, and that's perhaps one of the most fundamental mistakes that I see from a lot of the startups, is this complete absence of due diligence to begin with, like you said. Yeah. It's just at all levels. So many founders or, ideologists, if you want to call them that, rely on kind of superficial promises and representations, especially from persuasive individuals, right? So somebody, let's say a group of people come, and I've seen this so much with my clients as well. Somebody very persuasive and just knows how to put on a good show. And people want to believe what they want to believe. They want to hear what they want to believe, right? Yeah, okay. And these people are very persuasive. On behalf of my clients, a lot of them, I mean, that's how they decided to invest in one idea or another. It's because they liked the sound of the idea, you see. They liked the sound of the idea, and they saw, like the energy of the person's presenting it to them. And they saw, their ideal that they wanted to see. And that's how a lot of founders, a lot of my clients invested in these startups, purely on that, purely on just the excitement, the aura, the gift of the gab, the presentation, and without really kind of asking the right questions, without just because, I guess it's the UAE and there's a lot of kind of excitement in the air in general. People were coming from all walks of life, from all corners of life, and they could present the story that they wanted to present.
Well, I was going to say, it's almost as though, when you set up, it was, the boom had kind of finished. So you, I guess, in some ways, you set up at a really good time because it was literally a fresh start in some ways. It's just that thing of it's really all about the presentation and being sold. And I wonder if some people in some industries think, I want to be in that industry. It's sexier. It's exciting. And is that what it is? There isn't a real foundation.
That's exactly it. And to be honest with you, there's a lot of that back then, 16 years ago, but I still see it now.
It's very much around now.
Yeah. And I think part of it is the UAE's overall success. It's done so much and it's grown so much and it's created so many amazing opportunities for so many different people and businesses from all over the world. And despite all the ill wishers over the years that thought this is it, the UAE is coming to an end, after the financial crisis, it rebounds and rebounds with a vengeance. So obviously the rest of the world sees it. And this is kind of the imagine. It's like it's the gold rush. You still see that. So that kind of exuberance exists in the air. Plus, the UAE is a fairly small country that's flushed a lot of money coming from all over the world because of all the legal foundation that it has in place, the safety, the modern amenities, the security. So the business opportunity, the kind of the welcoming laws and culture. It doesn't take much for a small country like that to be prosperous. And as a result, there's a lot of money that comes into the UAE. And so you combine that, a lot of money coming from the UAE to sort of seeking to be parked here and kind of utilized. And a lot of these youngsters that are sort of feed on the excitement and the idea of promise and the new frontier or the last frontier. It's just those two merge. There's a lot of, there's a lot of like, I want to believe. And there's, I know how to present a story because I know. And then there's money. And so it's just this, people get kind of caught up in this excitement and the urgency and they don't want to miss the moment. There's this urgency to act quickly and because you don't want to then look back and regret, if only I had. So, and that kind of exuberance, that excitement, that kind of hype, it just makes people kind of bypass the crucial checks and research that would have saved them trouble later.
Well, it does, doesn't it? But it's also, lots of entrepreneurs tend to be great salespeople. And you need that to get a business off the ground and to get the confidence of employees and investors, whoever it is you're trying to get to. It just always strikes me that there are certain things that should be red flags to anybody in any arena, in any business that we need to be aware of.
Oh, for sure. And the many. And to be, this is, I'm sure reasonable minds can differ and there are other perspectives. But to me, one of the biggest, recurring issues I have seen is just the is the lack of business experience. You know, sort of these founders, these startup and entrepreneurs that have an idea, may have an idea, but they don't really have business experience. Some of them actually don't really, don't even have specific skills per se, but they just know how to sell and how to get excited and how to connect people. Mm. So then of itself, and I've seen a lot of those come to my clients and ask for investments in their businesses. So there's, you know, some of that others may have actually very specific skills, like let's say engineering, IT, but they don't know how to run a business. I mean, let's face it, I didn't think that I would manage to succeed, and maybe I would have done a lot better if I had business experience when I set up. I was just a person coming in with my own set of skills, just being a lawyer, and then just organically developed a business on the back of that. But there's a lot of people that just because they're excellent at their profession, at their trade, don't necessarily, does not make them a good business person.
True.
What I see a lot here is that a lot of these kind of businesses, startups, are run by people who have very little business experience. The founders just don't really know. They don't have the business acumen, right? They just don't understand what it's like to run a business. They know about the idea and the vision, but you know what it takes between idea and vision to come to reality. That's where business experience comes in, and they don't have, many of them don't have. A lot of them are quite young when the UAE economy was here, especially during this financial boom. When there's just so much money and anything would take, it was a lot easier for these youngsters to start businesses and kind of make something work because everything at that time worked. But as the economy matures, it becomes more saturated, more mature, then it's, you know, then only kind of the more substantive businesses remain. So, you know, you could have, but back then, and especially now, you can have a brilliant idea, but without ultimately the ability to sustain it, you kind of fall into unrealistic budgets and forecasts, and then, you know, the focus often shifts to appearances, like investing in marketing and large-scale hiring and grand events, all to project an image of success. And that, by the way, happens a lot here. So yes. A lot of the time, these startups invest or raise capital. That's kind of the initial capital. That's where it goes. It goes in to create the big show. And over the years, I've seen so many of these kinds of shows, just the window dressing, the being on the cover of this magazine or that magazine, you know, these events and announcements. And it's just, there's a lot of, I guess, you know, PR, before PR became what it is today, with social media today, it's so much easier, right? But back then, it all kind of cost money. Like, you know, now you can kind of be your own PR agency just by opening up an Instagram or TikTok page. But back then, it cost a lot of money. And we have examples of clients who've, startups, so they raised cash, and how much of that cash initially they spent on just advertising and basically a PR campaign is just inordinate. It's just mind-boggling.
I think in a lot of ways it's kind of easier to be that way because you think you're building the business that way. But for a lot of entrepreneurs, the idea and the show and the look at me and the success is fine. But it ultimately comes down to the fact that you have to do the work.
Yeah. But you know, I think, and by the way, I probably should insert this. I did live through the .com boom and bust as well. So yes. I saw quite sort of similar practices back then. This was way long time ago.
This was in San Francisco.
It was in San Francisco. Okay. And I was just entering the legal profession then. And oh my goodness, just the money that sort of rained from the sky during the .com boom. And the tears that came down, mm-hmm. you know, after the bust, it was a lot of very similar tactics, you know, a lot of just these youngsters have ideas, and there was so much money that was coming in, and it's just, and you know, people, like, I remember these 20-year-olds were raising millions of dollars for some kind of like a nail polish, you know, I mean, and flying around creating these firm retreat, team retreats in Hawaii, across the world with investors' money, you know, going to expensive restaurants and such, all investors' money. I remember that. So I saw a lot of it then, and it was a lot of the window dressing, right? And but many of those businesses, I have to tell you, again, this is perhaps a gross generalization, and I just speak from my own experiences and experiences through my business to my clients is that it's almost like they don't really have a plan to really, really build a substantive business. It's more just to create the facade and then spin it off and sell it, right? And for somebody else. Yes. And so that's why the initial investment is so important to them, this impression that create this impression of success to be able to raise more money. Because, and then so what we've seen with a lot of these startups, they will announce to, you know, the world through whatever channels that, oh, we've already raised funding from X number of investors. These investors could just be their friends, right? And so, and they actually may not even have put any money in, but they're just going to lend their name. But so that creates some sort of level of credibility, right? That, oh, okay, so look, I've already raised X number of money from these investors. And maybe a few of these investors are known and, you know, in the industry for one thing or another. And then you hear this and you see me being published in some magazine or the other and social media and going to events and talking about this amazing idea I have and all the money. And it's all about, a lot of times, about the money I've raised. And so then you seem, okay, well, then obviously she's got an idea. So somebody has already, so these assumptions, presumptions that, okay, so she must have already been vetted with her business plan, because otherwise these investors would not have invested so early on. So she must be a genius. Look at her. She's so young and she's got such an amazing presence and has already been able to raise so much money. I'm kind of like Elizabeth Holmes, right, from Theranos. Oh, that was her. That was her. Very similar idea. So and so more investors start investing money. But because of, I guess, the speed of it, the course of how the whole, I guess I don't even know, maybe energy or aura, like the investors like yourself will not ask this basic due diligence questions. You see, so, and you kind of scratch your head and you're thinking, but why? But you've seen better, you invest in better businesses and more businesses. Why didn't you ask those questions, so basic questions? But it's all kind of on this, on the back of this exuberance that investors are thinking, okay, well, so early on she invested this, she already raised this much money and she's taken this far, and look at her on the cover page of this magazine and that magazine, and she's got this amazing office and she's got this great team of 50 people, so she must be doing well. So the usual due diligence you would have otherwise have done elsewhere, you kind of, you know, you so bypass here. So we've seen cases like this before. I mean, there's been some bigger scale examples. So, but that's basically kind of how I explain how it is that you as an investor kind of get sucked into this vortex of just, you know, charm and flashy statements and presence, and forget to ask questions in the process.
If you're an investor, what should you be aware of? What do you need to be wary of? Where are the red flags? What do you need to think? No.
Yeah, there are certainly some common patterns and common practices that should raise some red flags or some kind of aura of suspicion. So those founders, for example, who often maintain a sort of shroud of secrecy and to dodge questions or answer certain questions from colleagues or investors. And also, you know, one of my biggest red flags is somebody who just makes everything sound so perfect. And so just amazing and awesome. And that's kind of like to the point of where you couldn't even bring yourself to challenge them. So that kind of attitude often sort of masks the deeper issues. And just generally like avoiding direct answers and making up elaborate stories about some supposed, you know, issues that with the company. And they usually, like, when it kind of continues to the story or the excuse continues to evolve from one day to another, usually that's sort of a warning sign of something. And generally speaking, these behaviors are actually designed to divert attention and create the illusion of control and kind of success, when in reality, the business may be on super shaky grounds. So those are sort of the patterns I've seen. And in fact, recently we've had a few clients that have, you know, come to kind of, you know, in some ways seek advice, in other ways just seek comfort and solace in the mistakes that they made, and kind of have their fears appeased to an extent too. I didn't even notice, but as they were sort of describing the stories, I've had this happen to me a few times. I guess sort of the mannerism that I displayed, sort of kind of like a smile, and they could pick up that I've seen this before, I've heard this before, and it's just, and I guess it becomes almost So subconscious, my mannerism, my body language. But I've seen this. These are the patterns when somebody starts describing a story like that. It's just everything is amazing. Everything is huge. Everything is super. But yet you ask questions and there's always deflecting the actual answer. And then whenever you're starting to press them, they kind of go on the attack. Usually those are the signs that something maybe is a little cracking.
And that really undermines trust, doesn't it? It makes it really difficult for genuine investors, people who really want to make a difference, want to build something. And then, you know, the employees, it's impossible then to really assess where this company might be or may get to. There's just no way of knowing.
Indeed. Well, the thing is, you could, if you actually asked the right questions and if you pressed to get the information and the documents early on. But again, this is this kind of desire to believe, a desire to see the rainbow and lollipops and unicorns. It's just, you know, the question somehow, but also it's coupled with this presence and the aura of like, you know, I mean, how could you doubt me? You seen, have you read the news? Have you heard me speak? You know, there have been some very, very high profile cases to that effect. If you recall, it's like the one MBD scandal, the Malaysian sovereign wealth fund. Yeah. Yes, that was a huge one. Same, you know, I read the book, Joe Lowe, the guy there, just with really no particular background, and how he was able to convince and swindle so many incredibly high profile, some of the world's most high profile investors into believing the sort of the veneer that he presented to them. In fact, that's one of the books that I often advise my clients, because they come here and they just beat up themselves. So like, look, you were laughing because obviously you've seen this 1,000 times. How could I be so naive? How can I can be so simple minded to have fallen for it? And that's one of the books that I offer. So listen, you read this book. It just happens at all levels. You know, there's some of the world's largest institutional investors fell for this. And then there's the Abrash Capital, which is also one of our former sort of Dubai darlings. I mean, they're like the World Bank, you know, fell for it. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So when you're talking about institutional investors forgetting to ask the basic questions or due diligence, you know, it's obviously just, it's all too human. So how can you blame or criticize just the pure kind of mortals who are idealistic and they want to believe, and they also have something to offer. So they, you know, it's all that combination. Okay, I want to create something special too.
It doesn't come from a bad place, though, does it? I'm just thinking of an example. It's nothing to do with business, but a friend of mine recently said to me, have you heard of grounding sheets? Do you know what a grounding sheet is?
I am not sure about the sheet, but I've heard of grounding in different shapes.
Well, a ground sheet to me was something you had on the bottom of your tent so you didn't get wet. But a grounding sheet is a sheet you put under your sheet in your bed and you plug it into the wall.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I've heard of that.
So
okay.
It's supposed to send positively charged, I don't know, electrons or something through, and it's supposed to give you a great night's sleep. And this friend of mine was explaining this to me and was really excited because they were going to get one. And I just thought, that just doesn't sound like, that sounds like nonsense. I don't believe that. And I said, are you sure? And I don't want to be rude to my friend. And I thought, no, I don't think I believe in that. And I kind of left it. And then when they left, I Googled it and I was thinking, is there anything in this? And there is zero science behind it at all. There's wishful thinking. There's fantastic marketing. But it's very much like this, isn't it? It's something you want to be true and you want to make work.
For sure. But yeah, absolutely. And again, this is human nature, right? We all want.
It is. It's not
we
want.
Many of us are sort of inherently optimistic. We're optimists, yeah? Sure, and we want to see the rainbow and the sunshine. And, you know, obviously, and it's easier to feel that in the UAE with like the UAE sort of recent rapid success, right? And the optimism is kind of grounded in actual history. I mean, look around. So people want to believe, and they want to believe they can replicate the success quickly. And that obviously makes them more susceptible to overlooking the red flags and being swept up in the hype. You know, it's like there's the grounding. I've heard actually of it. And some people have spent quite a bit of money trying to to believe in the solution of grounding. Yeah, I'm no scientist, but yeah, that's basically an example of how ideas kind of are raised, and you know, depending on who's trying to sell them, some of them actually get some traction, and they even maybe develop into something, and may even be then spun off into another business or even bought. It's, you know, some of them, it takes several years to identify that there's really no substance behind. Certainly there is there's a lot of it's all kind of based on belief, and as a result, people forget to just kind of ask the basic questions about, you know, but like you just said, grounding. Okay, that's science based. Maybe I should go and look before I invest. Maybe I should like hire a scientist, or maybe there should be like a scientist on the board of investors who can kind of give us some of their expertise on is there actually any substance behind it. You know, as a business person, you may have the money. You know, as a lawyer, I may also believe, and I have the tools to structure a legal deal. But then it's something like this is technical. You should have a scientific. You should maybe have somebody else on the board who actually can lend some credence to the science, if there is any.
I mean, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Indeed. And that is like my motto, my logo here. So many clients come to me crying that they invested and lost this money or that, and it was all, in most cases, it's because they you know, believed that some amazing idea where they'd make 20-30% on their investment within just a few months, and it's just, well, it is, yeah, it's just too good to be true. So
it's chasing figures, isn't it?
Indeed.
I mean, the thing is, if you too many shortcuts can't be a good thing in a business. You have to do the work, and you have to put in the hours, I guess. Why do you think founders, or some founders, not all founders, are so hesitant to bring in experts? Is it, you know, I know what I'm doing, or is there something more to it?
I think it's part of it is that, and these days it's so much easier to be an expert in everything, right? It's one expertise in that one little soul, because you've got the internet, you've got ChatGPT, so it's so much of that, of what you would have in the past needed advisors and experts for, now is kind of accessible out there, and you know, and sort of in the world, to be through social media, through the internet, and through ChatGPT, or various forms of artificial intelligence. So all of a sudden, in the past, I would have gone to a lawyer to ask me to draft some agreements for my business. Well, now I can just ask ChatGPT. Maybe I would have gone to an accountant or tax advisor to try to understand the tax ramifications. I can go to ask ChatGPT. So it's, you know, in the way, and there's a lot to be said for those services, by the way, for those tools. And it's that also, those tools do and will in the future make it more accessible for people, for individuals to start businesses, because they will have access to much more information, sort of basic information that they need, and otherwise in the past they would not have been able to afford, right? Yeah. So it's a great tool, and I'm sure it will lead to many successful ventures, just because it allows people that sort of the jump start. Their learning and their path. But ultimately, if you are a serious business that wants to set yourself apart from other businesses, you will need experts. You know, you will need experts. So you will need actual lawyers. You will need actual accountants, and you know, and auditors, and you'll need engineers or finance experts. And so there's that part of it. The other part is that, you know, a lot of the businesses who get so excited, or maybe, I don't want to, you know, sort of impute any kind of sinister motives, but sometimes when you bring experts, it's very easy to see that the idea may not have much merit to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. And so part of it, that could be the other option, is that others are not bringing the actual experts for that reason, because it would be very easy for some certain kinds of experts to scratch the surface and see that their veneer is very thin and beneath it there is nothing. And in fact, this is why, for example, in the Silicon Valley and a lot of the more historically developed startup incubator places and jurisdictions, the practice is such that whenever you have a startup, there's a board. Before investors actually put in money, there's a board that's formed.
Yes.
What is a board? A board is advisors, right? Mm-hmm. Advisors from all walks of industries that will pertain to that particular startup. So we don't have that here, right? So it's the board are usually your friends and family who then you use to help you raise more funds, but they're not actual board necessarily with actual experts. But that would basically, that's what would help a lot of these businesses actually succeed. Because I'm not saying that a lot of these ideas are not good ideas or that they never stood a chance. It's just that the foundation on which they're trying to kind of launch is flawed in many ways. And so part of it is because they want that very quick glory and success, or the appearance of success. And if you start spending money on experts, you're creating a board that kind of pulls you back and makes you invest money in something other than PR campaigns.
Yeah.
So therefore it's, they may not even be aware of it at the time because it's so important for them to make it big and make it quickly, and that certain point in time, they just collapse under their own weight because the foundation is flawed, right? It's like walking on eggshells.
Well, that could be execution. It could be the primary motivation of a founder, I guess, for those, unsuccessful startups. But there is the other side. There are some really successful startups, obviously.
Absolutely. And those are the startups basically that do exactly that. They ask the basic questions, right? Mm-hmm. They ask, they do the due diligence, they bring in experts, they have the forecast, they have the budgets, and their forecasts are measured and grounded in reality. They know it's not realistic to have double growth figures within 6 months, which is a lot of the forecasts I have seen. they do things and they draw on experience of other businesses and other startups. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more accountability from the beginning and at all levels. And most importantly, that they are cognizant of not allowing any single individual to have control over everything, right? And visibility into everything, just and only exclusive visibility, which is what happens to a lot of these startups. They kind of close this, hold the cards very close to their chest. And in some businesses, which I've seen from my clients, they're the only ones who have access to the bank accounts, to the financials, and they just want this, going back to this secrecy, the shroud of secrecy, and that's done intentionally. But there's a lot of professional and successful businesses that understand that if you want to make it big, you need to kind of have everybody on board. Everything has to be transparent. Everything has to be on the table so that collectively you can account for different eventualities and be prepared for different risks. And, kind of as a parting comment is just, it seems to me that a lot of these businesses, they don't ever consider failure as eventuality. So everything they do is all with this, we're going to make it big, we're going to make it big. Mm. And therefore, they don't really have a safety mechanism built in. They don't have an exit plan. They don't have the winding down plan. So because it's kind of not in their vision.
It's interesting that I was doing a podcast somewhere else recently, and that was one of the questions at the end of a guy who's built a business here in sustainable energy. And the question was, how have you done it? What's been the most important thing? And he said, look, I'll be completely honest. It's just I've built some resiliency. Because I've had some really tough times. I've nearly failed 3, 4, 5 times. And I had so much to get through and people on my back and creditors, all of the above. But the resiliency was the thing. And that's built on, I think, hard work and just a little bit of mental toughness. I that was the impression I got.
No, for sure. You have to have the mental toughness, but you also need to almost like hit the rock bottom to understand, what it really takes in life and then appreciate. And so when you have done that, then your next steps are much more measured and much more perhaps grounded and therefore, not necessarily realistic. More realistic, but it's not necessarily that's still the recipe for success because it may still not work out. Mm. But at least you're not going to fall as hard as so many other businesses fall.
Okay.
And you're not going to let down as many investors, as many employees, as so many of these businesses do. And that's, we've seen this a few examples recently from clients, that that the stories I just described right now, those are from actual case studies, actual case, real life stories from our own client base. And when they fail, they don't fail gradually. You see, they just go poof. And at that point in time, there's so many employees whose lives are at stake, whose livelihood, because they've got salaries that all of a sudden are not coming, but their lives are built on the expectation of these salaries. And they're built also on these promises, these loud and happy promises of we're going to make it big, we're going to do great. And so they make their life choices on the basis of representations, employees, that is. Right. And then when the business, it doesn't just gradually wind down, it just kind of explodes or implodes under its own weight. It's, you know, it leaves a lot of carnage and it creates a lot of damage for a lot of just ordinary people. And it's just not fair. It's not fair to the employees, it's not fair to the suppliers, to the service providers. And so it just would befit everybody and to be a little more sensible and a little more informed and measured in their own expectations. And hence, that's why we are doing this podcast.
Well, exactly. I was just going to say to you, final thoughts there, really. How would you conclude? Could you put that together in a couple of sentences?
Well, sure. So in my view, I mean, number one reason is many startups don't succeed is that their founders lack of real business experience. Mm-hmm. This leads to other problems such as unrealistic plans, poor financial management, and reluctance to bring in professional guidance. And the biggest lesson is, you know your limits. Understand when to seek expertise and when to rely on those with the right knowledge, built thoughtfully, prioritize substance over appearances, and don't cut corners. And, you know, if you want an assurance of long-term success.
Business setup, business startup, how to perhaps be slightly more successful. Listen to Ludmilla, because that's what I do.
Good, Chad. This is why I'm sitting here in my chair.
Ludmilla Yamalova is the managing partner of Yamalova & Pleska, a legal firm here in Dubai. As always, Ludmilla on Logical, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Do appreciate it. You can find us online. TikTok, LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, you name it, on socials. You can find us on our website, lylawyers.com. To get a question answered, get in touch, or to have a question answered on Logical, go to lylawyers.com and click contact.